This is an LA Times Studios podcast.
The following program is presented by KRCA. The next 100 years. A probe into the future by the world's top scientists. Here to introduce tonight's guest is Mr. James Miller, Director of Caltech's Public Relations Department.
Good afternoon. Certainly one of the most important problems faced by Southern California and many other communities is the problem of air pollution. Wherever millions of citizens...
What you're hearing is from a long-ago television broadcast called The Next 100 Years.
The problem of smog in Los Angeles is particularly difficult because of the lack of prevailing winds. Hence, Los Angeles must be much cleaner than most other cities in order to have tolerably pure air.
This program was from 1959, and it's about air pollution in Los Angeles.
I take pleasure in introducing Dr. Hagenschmidt, who will speak to you on the subject, the air and you.
Good afternoon.
The good doctor is standing at a lab table bearing a big round glass flask and what looks like a long necklace of huge wooden beads. In fact, it represents a molecule that, even at its actual size, millions of times smaller, is altering the quality of life across Los Angeles and parts of Southern California.
Most people don't give much thought to air. It's, after all, invisible and doesn't seem to have much weight. And so we only hear about air when it is too hot or too cold or perhaps too smoggy.
In the movies, the hero rides to the rescue in a white hat. This time, the hero wore a white lab coat. Dr. Ari Hagenschmidt, a man you've most likely never heard of, but he is probably the single most important figure when it came to cleaning up the air in Southern California. Until Dr. Hagenschmidt got to work, Southern Californians were often pretty clueless about why their air had turned from fresh to foul in the space of a decade or so. Angelenos could see the smog, they could taste it, and nobody seemed to be able to figure it out, much less put a stop to it.
This is very often not realized by people, and they don't think about the fact that a general overall pollution in the basin might be there, but the local pollution might be most exasperating to the person that lives here, and this causes a great deal of bad feeling.
Now, no one else has seen or heard this film for maybe decades. We had the thrill of discovering it when a Caltech professor named Rick Flagan told us that years earlier, he had found a can of film stuck away in a closet. Thankfully, we were able to restore this film and to bring Professor Hagenschmidt back to life, his face, his words, his findings, nearly 50 years after he died. It's like a time machine, a glimpse into LA's polluted past and a hint of its clearer future. Here's the episode wherein we switch literary genres from the fairy tale to the murder mystery. It's late July in the summer of 1943, and a gross, choking, brown thing has settled over Los Angeles. And just like in a murder mystery, at first they fingered the wrong suspect. A gas plant near downtown Los Angeles making something called butadiene. Most people hadn't heard of butadiene before, couldn't even spell it, and it hardly fit in a headline. But the factory obediently shut down for a bit, and everybody thought it was one and done, solved. But more of what they'd called a gas attack, and those daylight dimouts kept happening in 1944, in 1945, and a lot more days were starting to look like July 1943. But as people said, there's a war on. Los Angeles was one vast chemical, metal, and petroleum factory supplying our boys in the Pacific and in Europe with the firepower they needed. There were plenty of clues and guesses about what caused it. A lot of the betting was on sulfur dioxide, that choking soot from coal, but LA wasn't burning coal. At one point, some frustrated experts just gave the substance a name out of a sci-fi movie. Component X. Chip Jacobs, the co-author of Smogtown, explains.
There was no science. From 1943 to 1950, the science was so inferior, so marginalized, and kind of like today, false equivalencies. I hate false equivalencies. Throughout the rest of America, where there had been air pollution problems, none as bad as LA, it was usually the result of a sulfur product coming out of a smokestack. And the belief was, well, sulfur was the culprit in St. Louis, thus it must be the culprit in Los Angeles. Completely wrong.
And then the war came and it went, and the smog came and it didn't leave. They couldn't blame the Japanese anymore, or even the wartime industry. Something was killing Angelenos, and they didn't even know how or where it came from.
Interestingly, in a region with, you know, USC, UCLA, Occidental, there's a lot of college professors in the LA area. Nobody had done what Dr. Hagen-Schmidt had done.
But when Ari Hagen-Schmidt told LA what his research had turned up, it's fair to say that most everyone, from oil refineries to car makers to the millions of Angelenos behind the wheel, was not ready to hear that news.
This is an extremely disturbing situation. With the greatest effort, we might perhaps be able to hold the line for a while, but the time soon comes when existing controls are again neutralized by further increases in industry and other activities of people in general. And in an appraisal of the future of such a problem, so serious as air pollution, wishful thinking has no place, and only an objective and realistic approach can help us in finding the right course to take.
I'm Pat Morrison, and you've crossed the border into Smoglandia.
Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. They're drinking the water and breathing the air.
What people, I think, fail to realize, initially, L.A. was very alone in this fight.
That's Chip Jacobs again.
The federal government could not care less about L.A. air pollution. It was a local problem for them to fix with some engineering dial. The governor of California did not care. He did not want to get involved in a L.A. pollution issue.
So I decided to use that 16-millimeter time machine and visit the epicenter for this epic discovery. It was a school originally named the Troop Institute, set on some lovely acres of Pasadena and dedicated to engineering. You'll know it by the name it's had for more than 100 years now, Caltech. Almost four dozen Nobel laureates have worked here. A man who received two of those prizes, Albert Einstein, spent three winters here in the 1930s. He said then that the place was like a paradise of sunshine and clean air. And every year for some 20 years, the celebrated physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking spent a month here. That's where I met him a couple of times, right before one of the student-cooked dinners of the extremely spicy Indian food that Hawking loved. When Caltech heard we were putting together this podcast about air pollution, they matched us up with the guy.
Now, that box there is an instrument from Hagen-Schmidt.
Is it really? When Dr. Richard Flagan opened his office door to us, he had on hand an odd little gizmo he'd rescued from a retiring colleague's closet. Small, but astounding for what it did.
That was his early ozone monitor. It's very, very simple.
I'm sitting on a sofa in Dr. Flagan's office, and there it is on the coffee table in front of us. So simple a contraption to answer such a complex puzzle.
That's one I happened to find.
On eBay, right?
No, I found it in a Caltech closet 40 years ago.
Oh, my God.
And I just said, I've always been interested in history. And I just said, you know, this is something that shouldn't be thrown away, shouldn't be buried in a closet.
If you hadn't guessed, Dr. Flagan is also the man who found that Hagen-Schmidt film neatly coiled in a standard old metal film can. He thought it could be important, and he held on to it all these years. Like Hagen-Schmidt, Dr. Flagan is an expert in atmospheric science, but when he came to Pasadena, where he's the McCollum-Corcoran Professor of Chemical Engineering and Environmental Science, he had already visited L.A., as so many of us first did, as a tourist. He was a kid in the 1950s tagging along with his dad.
My father had some business in Southern California, and we drove across the country and came into Los Angeles. And when we came into the L.A. base and came over the mountains and started coming down into this terrible haze, foul smell, That was my introduction. We spent a couple of weeks here, and I recall not seeing my shadow and getting an incredible sunburn. The smog was so bad, you didn't see the sun. You just saw the dense haze. I swore at that time that I would never live in Southern California. It was just so foul.
Yet here he wound up at Caltech in the still smoggy 70s, working outdoors in the thick of it, doing some of the work that earned him California's Hagenspitt Award for clean air. Part of the work was strapping a giant research balloon to the roof of a building.
We had a big Teflon balloon, big pillow-shaped balloon, about 60 cubic meters, 60 cubic yards. We would fill it with clean air, add to it particular reactants, and study how they reacted, how the sunlight drove the photochemistry, leading to the production of ozone and other oxidants, leading to the production of materials from feeds that were initially in the vapor phase, transformed into particles that were the haze that you see in the smog.
Did your results surprise you at all?
We constantly were learning. And yet, there were many surprises along the way.
From the beginning, Caltech has this magic where it's exciting. It's new. It has grand ambitions. It's attracting the very best researchers.
This is David Zoerler, the director of the Caltech Heritage Project.
And it's the thing that attracts actors to come to Los Angeles and surfers and people who are interested in adventure and freedom and sunshine and all of that.
In 1937, it attracted an intense Dutch chemist named Arie Hagenspitt, who came to teach and to research.
He came here like almost every very promising professor comes here in the 20s and 30s because it was clearly a place that had aspirations and already a record of excellence. And it felt wide open at the time, and you could do whatever you wanted here.
L.A. was not yet the polluted place it would become, and Hagenspitt's specialty also seemed to be a long way off from smog.
Arie Hagenspitt came to Caltech as a biochemist, and he was trying to understand the chemistry of flavor. One thing that he was looking at was what is the origin of the taste of pineapple? He had a greenhouse. He had lots of plants.
His must have been a popular lab for the leftovers.
That I don't know. I was not here at the time.
For some years, Hagenspitt labored in the Caltech labs and classrooms, supporting his wife and three young children. Years later, his wife, nicknamed Zeus, told a Caltech interviewer that the couple were able to buy their house in Pasadena because Hoggy, that was his nickname, Hoggy had a side hustle, earning extra money testing the urine of racehorses for illegal doping. The word nerd wouldn't come along until after World War II, but on a campus supposedly populated by that type, Hagenspitt looked like he'd wandered in off the MGM lot by mistake.
He was strikingly handsome. He was very confident, very kind. He was understated among his colleagues. And he liked to wear a white lab coat. He was always the mild-mannered professor, and you'd think he was happiest in the lab. And that made him very much on brand for who Caltech professors were and are.
Hagenspitt would probably have been happy to keep working among his plants and Erlenmeyer flasks for the rest of his career. But dead plants and a live scientist and inventor, a very lively one, sent him in a different direction. One that put Hagenspitt right smack into the maelstrom of L.A. smog.
One of his colleagues said, there's all kinds of plants that are dying in my garden, around Caltech. Try to figure out what's going on.
That lively fellow was a Caltech grad, Dr. Arnold Beckman, a chemist himself, an inventor of vital scientific instruments, and a businessman who funded and promoted foundational work in electronics.
If you look at photos of Beckman, first of all, the big thing that jumps out at me is his piercing gaze. I never met him, but in all of the photographs, it looks like he could look right through you with his eyes. He was always intently focused.
Years later, at a dinner in Hagensmith's honor, Beckmann recounted how he met this flavor-obsessed Dutchman and lured him into the study of smog. Here's Times colleague Steve Clow reading from that speech.
Why did Dr. Hagensmith, a brilliant young biochemist facing a bright future in an exciting field of research, decide to abandon his research and engage instead in the nasty, unglamorous, inglorious field of air pollution? I can shed some light on this question, for I was responsible, in some measure, for getting him into the act. It may be of interest to review briefly some events that led to this drastic change in his life. Before the early 1940s, there was little public concern over atmospheric pollution in the Los Angeles area. Pasadenans told visitors of this problem proudly. On a clear day, you can see Catalina.
Beckmann also hinted at Hagensmith's whimsical nature. When people called him the father of photochemical smog, his answer was, "Who's the mother?" Joking aside, the number of those clear to Catalina days began to get fewer and further between. For all that anyone could see, Catalina Island might as well have been at the bottom of the sea, keeping Atlantis company. After the war, Beckmann became a scientific advisor to LA's Rudimentary Air Pollution Control Operations, an organization that existed only to figure out what the hell was causing the smog and how the hell to stop it. Dr. Lewis McCabe became the head of LA's Air Pollution Agency.
Dr. McCabe set out on a campaign to reduce dust, smoke, fumes, and sulfur dioxide.
The ask was huge, and the power to make it happen, minuscule. Its success rate, hit or miss.
The poor chap was being harassed from all sides. Industry said that he was being too tough and unreasonable. Others accused him of being not tough enough. Mr. William Jeffers, who had recently retired as president of Union Pacific Railroad and was chairman of the Citizens Smog Advisory Committee, blasted McCabe in the press. "What's the matter with McCabe?" he asked. "He's been on the job for 3 months and pollution is just as bad as ever." Dr. McCabe's reply to our request was, "There's no time for research." Eventually, we persuaded him that an analysis of polluted air was essential.
In his speech, Beckmann refers to William Jeffers, the head of a Citizens Smog Advisory Committee, and the former head of Union Pacific Railroad. And keep in mind, railroads were a big polluter. That McCabe was a frustrated man was clear as early as 1949, when he suggested that Angelenos had been misled about the seriousness of the smog problem and that industry had managed to block clean air proposals.
This is the point at which Dr. Hagensmith entered the scene.
The air still wasn't clear, but the message sure was, time to get a new sheriff in Smogtown. Arnold Beckmann had just the man in mind for the job. His choice was Professor Ari Hagensmith, and not only did Hagensmith's discovery profoundly alter the future of California, of cars, of public health, and of LA's self-image and identity, it changed his own life. From the stereotype of the unknown scientist in a lab to a very public and not always popular figure.
Obviously, a highly skilled microchemist was needed. Dr. Hagensmith was asked whether he would perform the analysis, and he kindly agreed to do it.
Beckmann was about to draft a man who had devoted his life's work to analyzing the scent and flavor of compounds in plants, cashews, radishes, onions, and of course those pineapples, and instead to set him to work to figure out the mystery of smog. This is how Hagensmith's wife, Zeus, remembered it, being read from her Caltech oral history.
Ari was working on the flavors of pineapple at the time, and that was all microchemistry. He had been condensing fumes from the pineapple to make a very small volume in order to do a chemical analysis on it.
Between them, Hagi and Beckmann devised unique instruments for experiments that Hagi also often designed himself. One of the most effective was one that Rick Flagan showed me, a cold trap to collect air samples, or as Flagan called it,
used a cold trap, collected some samples, essence of smog.
The essence of smog is this, organic chemicals set loose in the air, and what happens to them when they encounter one essential and surprise element.
Now, those two components, the hydrocarbons and the oxides of nitrogen, react in sunlight to give the eye-irritating material that we know so well.
Okay, one step at a time. First, oxides of nitrogen, also known as nitrogen oxides. And no, it is not laughing gas, or otherwise this would all be completely hilarious. No, it's what launches into the air when you burn fossil fuels like oil or natural gas or coal, which we do all the time, in industry, in power plants, in gas stoves, and of course in cars and trucks. It's what humans have done ever since we figured out how to set fire to stuff. Now, hydrocarbons, they can be part of a family of things called volatile organic compounds, VOCs, and those you find in nasty chemicals like benzene and toluene. Hagi described it like this.
And then, curiously enough, there is a compound ozone formed, and ozone is a very active form of oxygen consisting of three atoms of oxygen instead of two like ordinary ozone.
These VOCs are everywhere in just about everything we've created somewhere along the 20th century. They're compounds that turn up in nail polish remover, candles, detergent, glue, some paints, some fabrics, some perfumes, insulation. They even create that new car smell that people love and which we might not like so much if we called it by its more technical name, off-gassing. Still with me? Good. Gold star for you. Anyway, when these two get together in the environment, like in the air, and then beams of nice warm sunshine hit them, they create sensitive little baby molecules that science calls free radicals, but let's just call them sensitive little baby molecules. And that creates ozone. Now, ozone on its own has no color or smell, but mix it in with these other bits and it begets yellowish, brownish, grayish, stinkish smog. And ozone that's way up high, I'm talking as low as 6 miles above us and as high as 30 miles, that's good ozone. That's the stuff that shields us from dangerous ultraviolet light. The bad ozone is poison, and that's what's right here with us at ground level. Understanding the specifics of smog chemistry was beyond most Angelenos, this one included, but no one could fail to understand the famous rubber strip test. Here's how it worked. Hagi and his assistants kept exposing a loop of rubber to big whooshes of LA's smoggiest air, and literally, right in front of their eyes, in literally 7 minutes, the rubber cracked and split.
One of the indications of the effect of the ozone was the rubber would crack.
And this was happening all over Southern California, to people's tires, their windshield wipers, to rubber gaskets and hoses. I remember taking my car into the repair shop, and the man in the overalls would tell me, very matter-of-factly, gotta replace them, you know. This is what happens to rubber in L.A. Like, forget it, Pat, it's Chinatown.
And the practical science, that became very important because the ozone, the pollution, the smog was catching everyone's attention. You couldn't ignore it.
If Hagi hadn't been much of an ice skater in his native Netherlands, in L.A., he sure had to learn fast because he was about to go skating on thin ice, politically and in a lot of other ways.
But he added to that the automobile as a focal point. And he started trying to understand it and ultimately to understand the effects of it.
Keep in mind that for a half dozen years, the not very powerful smog authority had been dinging factories and chemical plants and garbage dumps with good reason, because they were befouling the air. But still, the smog had not vanished. And Hagi, instead of looking out to the industrial landscape, had looked somewhere else, somewhere as close as people's garages. So the fairy tale curse had finally come home to roost. Angelino's two greatest loves, their sunshine and their cars, were conspiring to create one of the worst blights on their lives, photochemical smog. So he must have been regarded in some circles as the skunk at the picnic. You're blaming cars?
He had lots of people who did not like his story, yes.
America in the 1950s was car mad, loony, insane, and Los Angeles was the throbbing engine of the auto erotic. Amateur racers, pimped out coupes, woodies and ragtops, sedate sedans, souped up hot rods, all share the brand new wide open freeways and boulevards. We were out there having fun in the warm California sun. For 50 years, composers had been writing syrupy songs about sweet little California bungalows with fragrant orange trees. Our state song was written by two Angelinos. Now the popular music was about Corvettes and GTOs and that brand new shiny red super stock Dodge. And here comes this Dutchman with a weird name and a PhD telling us that our cars and trucks were the problem. That there may be a shiny grille and big hood ornament in the front, but it was all noxious exhaust crap in the back. Hockey himself test drove the freeways in a Plymouth, fitted out as a test mobile. It had a specially made detector to analyze carbon monoxide, which, among its other problems, makes drivers less alert. And how did we thank Dr. Ari Hagensmith for this stupendous, life-altering, life-saving discovery? Did they make him Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade? Did he win a Nobel Prize? No. This man practically saved Southern California from itself, and they didn't even name a freeway off-ramp in his honor.
This conclusion produced impassioned outbursts of protests, especially from the oil companies and the auto manufacturers.
Here's Arnold Beckman on what happened to Hagi after he published his findings.
Hagensmith was all wet, they said. Obviously, much more had to be done. Hagi did not wish to spend more time on the matter, for he had his research program to carry out.
Hagi wasn't expecting to have to go to the fight, but the fight came to him. He was, in fact, a champion boxer with big biceps under that lab coat, and he would not be backing down from a battle. Not long after Hagi's research hit the headlines, an outfit called the Western Oil and Gas Association opened its checkbook to fight facts with money, for starters. It was the public face of the petroleum industry, which was already hip-deep in the smog wars. It was blamed for airborne gunk from oil wells and refineries, for those blue-black lakes of oil right out there in the open, and it was feeling under siege by the prospect of more regulations. And now this chemist who'd studied pineapples was saying it was their products, their gasoline, their diesel fuel in almost every car and truck on the road that had a big hand in ruining the air. They'd had enough. So the association hired a big name to come up with its own set of findings, ideally to spread around the blame for smog and maybe even do a smackdown of Hagi's work, the Stanford Research Institute. Yeah, I know, Stanford, right? Woo-hoo. It set up a laboratory in South Pasadena, a few miles from Caltech. It seemed like all of Hagi's research might be lost to oily fingers. In a speech at a dinner honoring Hagi after he died, Beckman described what happened next.
I was reluctant to pressure Dr. Hagensmith very hard, for my conscience bothered me some. If I persuaded him to spend more time on air pollution matters, would I be guilty of interfering with his personal research programs, which quite possibly might lead to a Nobel Prize? Fortunately, that dilemma was solved by Hagi himself. One of the outspoken critics of Dr. Hagensmith's work was the Stanford Research Institute, which was doing work for an association of Western oil and gas producers. It happened that a member of the SRI staff was to give a talk on air pollution in the chemistry lecture hall at Caltech. I got Hagi to attend with me. After the speaker had described some of his own work, he attempted to discredit Dr. Hagensmith's work, saying that Hagi's research was not consistent with the SRI's findings, and expressed regret that a respected scientist such as Dr. Hagensmith could make such a serious mistake. Well, I could almost feel Hagi's blood pressure rise. He was furious. The validity of his work was being questioned. "I'll show them who's right and who's wrong," he muttered as we left the room.
Zeus Hagensmith echoed this sentiment in her Caltech oral history.
He was so mad. Oh, he was furious. So he was going to prove to them that they were wrong.
And boy, did he. Hagensmit was charismatic and good-looking, and if he had been making his case today, he'd be on Instagram and TikTok and swapping smog jokes with Stephen Colbert and doing with Martha Stewart in a TV studio kitchen exactly what he liked to do in stuffy lecture halls, proving his point by cooking up a flask of smog right in front of the audience's runny red eyes. Yes, car and truck engines were the biggest malefactors, but Hagi didn't stop with them. He blamed big business and big business interests.
He introduced a wholly new concept of air pollution that brought about a revolution in efforts to obtain clean air. He identified and courageously named the major sources of air pollution: the automobile, oil refineries, power plants, and steel factories.
Later, he'd talk about what he'd run up against. He said, quote, "I had a lot of trouble getting people to accept this. They said it was absolute nonsense and impossible, and the auto industry had the opinion that it was all none of my damn business." Seventy years ago, encouraged by air pollution agencies, he went out on the hustings like a candidate. He appeared in popular magazines, all to persuade Californians he was telling them the truth. Once in a while, his frustrations burst through. In December 1975, at a big air pollution conference at Caltech, he said, "The public wants clean air. Yes, they want clean air, if they don't have too much trouble. Sometimes I get the feeling we should just ignore the public and feed them the controls." But far more often, he was the happy and hopeful warrior, promoting clean energy and cleaner cars and public transit. About 6 months before he died, in March of 1977, he showed up to speak in an elementary school science class in the city of Monrovia, not too far from Caltech. And he did show and tell for the kids with his poster, "Smog Factory in the Sky." There's one more movie genre in the story of smog, and it's sci-fi. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist and sometime movie reviewer, got it right, that every disaster movie begins with a scientist being ignored. Smoglandia is hosted by me, Pat Morrison. Our senior producers are Mary Knopf and Jonathan Shiflett of Studio Phonic. Our editors are Hugo Martin, Shelby Grad, and Steve Clow. Our director of library services is Carrie Schneider. Additional sound design and engineering by Hannes Brown. Special thanks to our editor Steve Clow for voicing Arnold Beckman and Caltech professor Franca Hoffman for voicing Zeus Hagensmith. Our podcast marketing manager is Bryn Jura, and our product marketing director is Becca Dorman. Special thanks to LA Times Studio President Anna Mogzanian, President and Chief Operating Officer of the Los Angeles Times, Chris Argentieri, and Executive Editor of the Los Angeles Times, Terry Tang. Smoglandia is executive produced by Darius Derrickshawn.